You might recall that dramatic three-day rescue of a youth soccer team from a flooded cave in Thailand last year. It was so complicated that the boys apparently needed to be heavily sedated with their arms handcuffed behind their backs, according to a new book, Miracle in the Cave, by Liam Cochran. The 12 wild boars spent more than 2 weeks trapped in Thailand's cave complex after being flooded by an annual monsoon rains. The last of the members of the cave were pulled out by July 10th, drawing celebration across the world. But what really happened behind the scenes, that's the amazing story. And in a moment, we'll talk with Liam Cochran about Miracle in the Cave. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. So we're a worldwide program, and of course, last year, everybody worldwide was following this incredible story of the young soccer players who were trapped in a cave in Thailand. Now, our author tonight of The Miracle in the Cave is Liam Cochran. He's the Australian Broadcasting Company's Southeast Asia correspondent based in Thailand. He spent more than 2 weeks covering the cave rescue, and one of those weeks stationed outside the cave entrance in the mud with daily contact with the divers, other officials, and family members. On the day the first group of boys were brought out of the cave, he did live crosses on Australian TV and radio for 18 hours straight. Liam, welcome to the program, and you did great work on that episode, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you very much, George. It's lovely to speak with you and to all of your listeners.
What an incredible story. And it must have been emotional for you when they started bringing them out.
It sure was, and you mentioned the 18-hour stint that I and my team did, trying to update the world and update Australia with every last development. Towards the end of that, when we finally had confirmation that the final member of the Wild Boars football team was safely out of the cave, it was very emotional, and I got on TV for my live cross, and I had my earpiece in my ear, and we were ready to go, and the producer was counting me down 1 minute to go in my ear, and I said, hang on a second, I've just got to jump off camera and give my producer a hug. And as we went live to air after that, you know, I felt my throat tighten and a little bit of emotion well up after all those days that we were rooting for the boys and hoping they got out okay, and the coach, of course. It was an emotional thing, even for us journalists who were trying to stay calm and stay objective on the outside.
Indeed. Tell us about the team, the Wild Boars. What was their age?
The Wild Boars team, or the little subgroup within the Wild Boars Football Academy that went along with Coach Eck for this ill-fated adventure, they were aged between 11 and 16 at the time that they went into the cave. One thing we didn't really understand at the time was, by coincidence, four of them had birthdays while they were stuck inside.
Oh, jeez. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday indeed. One of them, in fact, had a birthday cake waiting for him in the refrigerator when they went in with the number 16 iced on top of it. And he was never to see that cake, but his family did get him a cake at the other end of the experience. So they were a group within the age range of 11 to 16, which, as your listeners will understand, that's quite a big age gap for kids that age in terms of their development. And the thing that drew them all together was the coach, Coach Eck. He used to take the boys on adventures after soccer practice, and they'd go riding their bikes, they'd go exploring the mountains around the town of Maasai, where they live in the northernmost corner of Thailand. And it was that love of the extra adventure and the physical challenges that he gave them that brought these boys together across three different age groups. They actually played in three different age divisions. And so that was the group that went, 12 boys and the one coach that headed into Thum Luang Cave that day.
Now, why did they go into the cave in the first place? I mean, what did they expect to see and do in there?
The simple answer is that they went for fun, as we all did things like that for fun when we were kids. A few of them and the coach had been in before, and this was just another one of their adventures. Many of the boys hadn't been before. They wanted to check it out. It was one of the better-known caves in this area.
Was it a tourist attraction?
Well, it was a minor tourist attraction, I would say, at the time. It's now Thailand's number one tourist attraction.
Yeah.
It's completely changed its fortunes now. There was sort of some local folklore that, for the teenagers and the kids in the area, that it was, they got significant bragging rights if they could walk all the way to the end of this cave and sign their name on the end, on the rock wall on the end of it. That was considered a pretty cool thing to do. So they were probably never going to get that far into the cave system on this day, because it is about 10 kilometres all the way to the end. They ended up making it about 4 kilometres, but that was the intention, to go in, have a look around for the kids that hadn't been in there before, and to have a bit of an adventure.
Liam, what did they use for lights and power? Did they just have flashlights?
They did have flashlights, several flashlights. The coach also had some rope, but that was about the extent of their supplies that they took in with them. They didn't have any food. That was one of the key things. But there's actually a really amazing story about the flashlights. On the first night that they got stuck, they dug for a while, and after deciding that there was nothing more they could do for that night, they lay down on the muddy dirt and one by one turned off their flashlights. And one of the boys, when he went to turn off that light, it jammed and wouldn't turn off. And they were, at that moment, they were in a cavern that was known locally by its nickname, the Planetarium. And that's because there were cave crystals in the mm-hmm. roof of the cave that would glisten. And so, although we had this impression of them for, sitting alone and scared in the dark, they may have been a bit scared, but for at least the first 4 days, they weren't in the dark, because this one flashlight was jammed and would not go off. And the battery, amazingly, lasted for more than 4 days. So on that first night, when they laid down their heads and tried to get some sleep, hoping for the best, hoping the water would go down the next day, they looked up, and the boys told me they saw these glistening crystals in the roof of the cave that looked to them like stars.
So they go in, they expected to be there, what, just a few hours?
That's right, a few hours.
They go into this cave, and they keep walking, and they keep walking, and they keep, and like you said, there was the number of kilometers. At what point did they really, and I'm sure it was not wet when they went in, what happened?
So as they went, the basic geography, just to give you a quick mental map, is that you go in for about, let me quickly do a conversion in my head, let's call it roughly a mile, and take a left-hand turn, which is where the boys went. So they continued from this T intersection, and when they crossed that T intersection, they did notice there was a little bit of water, there was a bit of a puddle there. But the coach had seen that the last time he was in the cave, mm-hmm. so he didn't think that was too much of a concern. And it was, of course, also just at the just before the typical beginning of the rainy season, the monsoon season here in Thailand. So they weren't really expecting rain. And so they passed by this T intersection. There was a little bit of water. They weren't too stressed about it. They continued on a significant distance, trying to get as far as they could. They reached some flooded passages, and they decided that they should probably turn around and go back. That time was ticking along. There was the birthday party for one of the boys that everyone was going to go to that night, and one of the boys had a tutoring session. So the clock was ticking for those two reasons. So they decided to turn around and go back, and they made it all the way back to that T intersection when they saw a different scene. They saw that the passage had flooded completely, and that the water was now trapping their exit. So unbeknownst to them, walking through in the middle of the mountain with hundreds of yards of rock, of limestone above them, they had no idea that the heavens had opened and that it had started pouring down rain, the sort of monsoon rain that, we certainly don't really get in the southern part of Australia. It's heavy, and the impact can be quite dramatic. And that's what traps them inside the cave.
It rained so hard you could barely see, and it probably rained for what, at least a couple hours at that pace?
That's right. For several hours, it was still raining into the evening and on and off over those first few days.
How high did the water fill up in the cave, Liam?
Well, it depends where you would measure that from the cave. So it's pretty much a flat cave. It doesn't go up and down too much, only by about 5 meters. So at the deepest parts of it, when the cave was fully flooded, there was 5 meters of water in it. And the water level was not static either. So from that first day where it blocked the T intersection, you could still walk from the entrance to that point in the cave. As in the subsequent days, the rain continued, the cave continued to flood, and the water actually pushed the rescuers back to the cave entrance, and it pushed the boys and the coach further deeper into the cave.
How did people know that they were in the cave in the first place?
So most of the boys rode their bicycles to the cave after soccer practice on that Saturday.
Ah, and left them outside.
Well, and one of them took his motorbike and gave his friend a ride on the back. So there was a motor scooter parked at quite an obvious place on the road as you would come up to the cave area. And from there, when it was starting to get to approaching dusk, some of the forest rangers who were stationed outside the cave to help visitors and to maintain the area, they noticed this motor scooter was still there. And so they went into the cave entrance, and there they saw a number of bicycles lined up on a handrail. It's a photo that I'm sure many of your listeners have seen before. Mm-hmm. And that was the realization that this was not just one person, this was a whole bunch of people somewhere in the cave. And it's all very easy now to, we know what the story is, we know what happened, but at that point they had very little idea of who was in the cave, how many people, how deep they were, had they gone left or right at the T intersection, had they gone in and come out of the cave, maybe they were up on the mountain. There were all kinds of possibilities at that early stage that were being explored.
People were praying that they had already gotten out, weren't they?
Yeah, that was at the very earliest stages, an early hope, and the mountain was certainly scoured for that. But it pretty quickly faded as rescuers went in to explore the cave a bit more. They found the slip-on sandals that most of the boys had worn in were discarded just near the T intersection, as were a couple of backpacks. Which contained phones and water and other supplies. So the boys had left them there thinking that that was just going to slow them down and they'd get muddy and dirty. So once the rescuers saw those signs, they realized that boys had got at least that far. And they also saw muddy handprints and footprints that gave them clues as to which way the boys had gone. They'd explore little side passages and come back all muddy, and they'd put their hands up on the wall for balance. And these clues sort of gave them a pretty good indication that the boys had turned left at the T intersection and they were probably a few hundred meters away from there. But they really didn't know for sure.
So they were in there for about 2 weeks. At what point did people discover them and get them some food?
They were in there for 10 days before they had any food, including the day when they went in. It was 10 days.
And no water either, I guess, right?
Well, they had no drinking water, no bottled water, nothing like that. They survived by drinking water that was dripping from the walls and from the stalactites within the cave where they were. And they sure did do a good job of picking a fantastic spot to seek shelter. I spoke with one of the local caving experts, who's a British gentleman called Vernon Unsworth. And he's rather obsessed by this cave. He's trying to explore it further and link it up to another cave and make it known how long it is, possibly the fourth longest cave in Thailand. So he knows this place extensively. And he and one of the divers, British divers involved, speculated and said that it was possibly the only spot they could have found that was high enough, that was steep enough to keep them dry and keep them alive, keep them drowning if the water rose further. And it had this supply of fresh water that was dripping like a tap, as the boys told me, dripping like a tap from the stalactites. And it had a very interesting name, this place where they were, where they sought sanctuary. In Thai, it's called Nuen Nom Sao. And for most of the reporting that I did up in the cave, that's what we called it. And I just, for some reason, didn't bother to get a translation. But actually what it means is the mound or the slope of the young woman's breasts, which is a reference to the shape of two of the stalactites that hang from the cave ceiling. So that's the spot that this football team found sanctuary.
Could they have had the water from the cave portion that was leaking in? Not the leaking down, but the water that trapped them. Could they drink from that?
I don't believe they did. That was very muddy. It was stirred up. It was a torrent. You've got to imagine a central drain pipe that was being pumped through the center of this mountain. It was incredibly muddy. And also being trapped there, there was a chance that that could have been contaminated by some of their toiletry runoffs. So that would have been a bad idea. So most of what they drank, as I understand it, was dripping from the walls and had been cleaned and purified by its journey through the limestone cracks from the top of the mountain.
So once they realized that the boys and the coach were in there, and then, of course, thinking maybe they're dead, who knows? What was the first original contact, Liam, when they realized these people are still alive?
Well, the first contact, for sure, that told them that the boys was alive was when the two British divers, John Volenson and Rick Stanton, made it deep into the cave, and they found the boys there. And the way they found the boys was quite amazing. It was through smell. They were popping up in each of the little air pockets that they reached, and they were taking off their scuba masks, and they were sniffing the air for signs of life. And eventually they got deeper and deeper, and as they were going, they were laying a guideline, which is a key part of cave diving survival. And it was a way to get back out, of course. And they were almost at the end of their line. They were just about to have to be forced to give up for the day. And they got to this air pocket, and Rick took his mask off and sniffed the air, and he smelled a foul stench.
Mm-hmm.
And his first thought was that it was the smell of decomposing bodies. And his heart
was a
horrifying thought.
Horrible.
Because at that stage, after 10 days, these two experienced cave rescue divers truly believed that they were probably going to find bodies.
Mm-hmm. They were of course, everybody did, I think.
Mm, exactly. And it's something that's happened to them before in their experience as a couple of the world's best cave rescue divers. But he called John back and he said, wait, take your mask off, smell the air. And they stopped and they looked around. They couldn't see anything. There was just this empty, muddy bank. And at that moment, the boys and the coach were up at the top of this about 45-degree angle muddy slope, and they were digging the back wall, trying to find some sort of escape route. And they realized the two parties didn't know they were both in that same area, but eventually the boys ran down to the edge, and they saw these two scuba divers, and at first started speaking to them in Thai, because they just presumed they were Thai,
mm-hmm.
and were quite surprised when these two foreigners had popped up in their little air pocket.
Now, and what's the first thing they did when they discovered them? They swam back and started bringing food, or what?
Well, the very first thing that they did, John filmed some of footage as sort of proof of life and to show the conditions that the team were in, and they were remarkably healthy considering what they'd been through.
You got to give the coach credit for that, I think.
Well, absolutely. Coach Eck did an amazing job. He is a young man who was only 25 years old himself, so quite a young man. He'd spent 10 years in a Buddhist monastery, and so he encouraged the boys to meditate. Each night before they went to bed, they would chant a Buddhist prayer to keep them hopeful, keep them calm, keep them focused. He did an amazing job.
Hold on, Liam. We're going to come right back after this break and talk more about your work, Miracle in the Cave. It's just dramatic. And welcome back to Coast. We are here with Liam Cochran. His book is called Miracle in the Cave. We're talking about the dramatic rescue of the 12 youngsters from Thailand and the coach that were trapped for about 2 weeks in a cave in Thailand. So, Liam, so they're sending food in. Are they pumping air in there, too? Do they need that, or has the cave got a sufficient amount of air at that time?
It did not, no. That was one of the things that really sped up the efforts and put some level of panic in the rescue efforts was one of the divers brought an air meter in, and that detected that the oxygen in the air was going down, and it was getting towards dangerous levels. If it had dropped a few more percentage points, the balance between air and carbon monoxide would have tipped over, and the team and the four Thai rescuers who stayed with them for most of the time after they were found would have slowly gone to sleep and died in there. So this was what really made the clock tick even louder. There was that. There was the weather forecast, because heavy rains had been forecast for about the 10th of July. So they had a few days to try and plan how to get the team out. But they had a bit of a break in the weather too. They did catch a bit of luck. But they knew that the heavy monsoon rains were coming again. And if they came again, they probably, that was it. That probably
yeah, the whole thing would flood.
Yeah, that would have been all over.
We were riveted here in the United States day by day with this incredible story. And, you know, people thought they're not going to make it. They're going to make it. And then there were a couple scenarios that people were coming up with to try to rescue them. You know, whether you would create some kind of tube-like system and kind of like slide them in under the water all the way through and stuff. But, I mean, was the cave, was it kind of windy and weavy? And it was pitch black in the water, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. It was pitch black, obviously, inside the cave. The water was stirred up with sediment, so for the divers, they had virtually zero visibility. On a good day, if no one had been through before them, they might have had a few inches to see. So it was all done by, all the diving was done by hand. They felt their way along the guideline. But you're right, all of the options that they that could be thought up were put on the table, and frankly, all of them were bad. They contemplated, as you say, some sort of inflatable tube. That was one of the Elon Musk suggestions that put forward, and they did actually trial that in a canal nearby. But as soon as they'd spoken with some of the Thai Navy SEALs about just how sharp and jagged some of the rocks are within the Tham Luang cave, they realized that would never work. They rescuers went to great efforts to try to drill an access hole using industrial drilling machinery that could go several hundred meters through rock. They actually had just started that process when and drilled a few meters into the limestone when the boys were found, and they called that off. But that was only going to drill a hole about 5 inches in diameter, so it was never going to get the boys out, but it was thought perhaps it could get some oxygen in, some yeah. food, water. It could be a lifeline to them. And, of course, one of the other options, perhaps the most favorable option for much of the rescue period, was to simply wait and just try and survive in there until the monsoon was over and the cave drained.
They tried to pump out the water, right?
Well, pumping was going on the whole time. Pumping started early and it did not stop. Huge resources were put into that, and that certainly made a difference from the entrance of the cave to what was known, became known as Camp 3, which is where a sort of a forward operating base was set up for the rescuers and the divers. Beyond that, it probably didn't make much difference, according to many of the hydrologists and experts that actually went in there. But it was a good effort. It was worth trying. As
sure,
it was.
Absolutely. I would assume the water kept coming in. The more they pumped out, the more just kept coming in.
Yeah, at some point they got it under control, and it became a matter of, you know, if it would rain a bit, the water would go up an inch, but it would go down pretty soon after.
That's right.
So they did control it.
Well, without pumping, it could have been a disaster, so that was probably well worth it.
Certainly.
Now, whose idea was it, Liam, to say, we're going to put some oxygen masks on these kids and we're going to get them out?
Well, amongst the divers who had cave diving experience, several of them always thought that was the only way it was going to happen. And the reason for that is it's a long, difficult dive, zero visibility. It's something that a recreational scuba diver would struggle with. It'd be a heck of an effort to pull that off if you were, you know, if you had a few dives under your belt. For these young boys who could swim a bit, but not really strongly, and had never been scuba diving before, it was just unthinkable that they could have a regulator in their mouth, they could have a mask over their eyes, they could stay calm as they were pulled
exactly.
through this.
And they had never done that before. No. They weren't scuba divers. No.
They had no experience like that. And frankly, I don't think I would have been able to stay calm as an adult while being dragged through that sort of terrifying situation, not knowing where you are.
You can't see.
Really knowing which way is up. You can't see anything. It's zero visibility.
Well, and then that's the one thing about scuba diving. Yes, I'm a certified scuba diver. If you're in pitch black water, you don't know if you're going up or down.
Correct. That's right. And so, and that factored into some of the planning that they did to get the boys out. So the first thing, as you mentioned, were these full face masks. And they differ to the typical scuba masks, which are two pieces, a mask and a regulator mouthpiece that you have between your lips. This is a single piece of plastic that goes over your, makes a seal around the whole face, from the forehead down the side of the face around the jawline. And the silicon seals around there keep the water out and keep some pressure in as the air is pumped in from a cylinder. That is considered an easier option for novices and certainly for these boys who are going to be sedated. And in terms of what you were just saying about not knowing which way is up or down, the other thing that they did was to put the oxygen cylinder, sorry, the air cylinder that would be connected and tethered to the boy, they would put that in front of him, strap it to his front, not his back, as you might imagine. And then, in addition, they put a lead weight on the front of that. And the idea was, if something went wrong and somehow the rescue diver and the boy became separated, the idea was the boy would sink down to the bottom of the cave, hopefully still face down, hopefully still breathing, and remain there, weighted down by that tank and by that lead weight until his rescue diver could feel his way around in the darkness and try.
Oh, the kid would panic by that time.
Well, the kid would have no idea.
Well, now that's what we're going to get into. But one quick question, Liam. How long did it take to get from the entrance to the cave to where the boys were underwater with the diver? How long did it take the diver to make that trip?
It took them walking, diving, wading. It took about 6 hours to get in and about 5 hours to get out, helped along a little bit by the flow of the water.
Are you saying they had to swim for 5 hours?
The water current was too strong in most parts to swim. They were mostly pulling themselves along the guideline.
For 5 hours it took?
Correct.
To go from point A to B, to get out of the cave would take 5 hours?
Correct.
Oh, my God. I thought it was just a matter of a half hour or something like that.
No, it was a huge undertaking.
Oh, my God. How would you have enough oxygen?
Well, as a diver, you would know that's beyond what you could do on a tank, two tanks, even the three tanks that they were taking in. So each of the divers had three tanks strapped to them, and they positioned spare tanks along the way to replenish supplies.
How could they find them?
They had systems worked out. They had different spots that had been sort of marked that they knew where they would be. They had a system of marking the tanks with different colors for which ones were full and empty. At some points in the rescue, they had like chem lights, those sort of glow-in-the-dark glow sticks that you snap and they come to life. They had those attached to the tanks that would light them up in green or red for 12 hours so the divers would know which tanks had air in them and which were empty.
Now, the ordeal, of course, will be, how do you get a kid who doesn't know how to be a scuba diver, who can't breathe, who's never had a mask on, most of them, how do you get him for 5 hours to breathe this tank without panicking or going crazy and getting him out with the diver? And, of course, this is where your story and your book has made it all around the world. It's all over the media today that these kids were sedated. Tell us about that.
That's right. The sedation of the boys was something that was absolutely necessary for their survival. It just couldn't have happened otherwise. They would have woken up, they would have panicked along the way and put their own lives in danger and possibly their rescue diver as well. So a decision was made at the time, very secretly, for an Australian anesthesiologist who is also an expert cave diver, one of only two people in the world who has that skill set, went in and put the boys to sleep using a powerful sedative called ketamine. He also gave them a couple of other things to help that process. So before the ketamine was injected into the boy's leg, he was given an anti-anxiety drug, best known by the brand name Xanax. That would calm him down. They would walk him down to the water's edge. The boy would sit in Dr. Richard Harris's lap, and Dr. Harry would give an injection into his leg of ketamine to put him to sleep and an injection into his other leg of an anti-saliva agent, so that while he was unconscious, he wouldn't drool into the mask and therefore create another drowning hazard.
And suffocate. So are you saying that they pulled these kids through for 5 hours and they were knocked out?
They were knocked out. None of the boys remember anything factual of the escape at all. But one of the most kind of heart-stopping things, I think, of the rescue and of the sedation process was that the rescue was going to take hours. It was going to take about 3 hours to get to Camp 3, which is sort of where all the diving part of it. And during that process, the ketamine would only last for about an hour. So each of the boys would have to be redosed to put them back to sleep. So each of the British recovery divers, the divers that actually took one boy each and one at a time dived them out, each of those expert divers had a little pouch with a preloaded syringe of ketamine separate from its needle, and at various stages they had to re-administer that. Now, most of the time this was done at various stations that were set up, and there were other dive instructors who'd volunteered to be there to help them. But on at least one occasion with Jason Mallinson, his boy woke up while they were in the water, while they were in a part of the tunnel which had no muddy banks on the side. So he was forced to just hold the boy as best he could, fumble around with his other hand to get these preloaded ketamine syringes out and try and re-administer that jab through the wetsuit. And he describes it, he's a very calm man. He's a stiff upper lip British guy who doesn't sort of say too much or exaggerate anything. And he said it was a pretty nervous moment with syringes and wrappers floating around in the water in the darkness in the tunnel.
These divers were heroes.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're a certain breed. People who go cave diving for fun generally have a certain kind of character. They're very careful. They're often extremely good at what they do professionally in the rest of their life. They're very sober guys who don't react emotionally to things, generally speaking, because that sort of reaction, of course, can kill you.
So these kids were knocked out with the breathing respirator in their mouth? What would keep them?
They had the full face mask was sealed tightly to their
almost like a helmet.
That's right, like to the front of their.
Okay, face. So they didn't have anything in their mouth breathing like a scuba diver would.
Correct.
Okay, so that helped it a little bit. So they're knocked out, they're asleep, they've got this helmet on, leak proof, and off they go. For a 5-hour trip.
That's right, although there was one more thing that was done to try and enhance the chances of the rescue being a success, and it was something that, it was probably the biggest revelation, I think, of the research that I did for the book, and it was something that certainly wasn't known at the time. But before each boy was put in the water to be taken out of the cave, the rescuers did one more thing, which may sound at first controversial, but was absolutely necessary. They cable-tied the boy's hands behind his back. And they did that so that if he did wake up along the journey,
he wouldn't panic
and start to struggle. He couldn't rip his mask off. He couldn't fight with the rescue diver. It was solely to try and help that boy survive and the coach survive that they did that.
It's the only way they would have been able to help them, I think, by doing that.
That's right.
Knocking those kids out. And once they got, let's say, the first one out, pandemonium, of course, people were cheering, crying. It was a miracle. How many divers did it take to get the 12 boys out and the coach?
Well, the actual, what they called recovery divers, which is the ones who actually took one of the boys and did the diving out, there were four initially, and then I believe two more guys came in to assist. So if I'm remembering correctly, I hope I am, a total of six recovery divers. Then there was a support team of another dozen or so diving instructors who are mostly based in Thailand, and they were stationed along the way to check their vital signs, to help swap tanks, to because at each point they got the boy in and out of his scuba gear and tank to carry him across the bit that wasn't flooded. So it was quite a slow process of getting him in and out of the gear. So there were dozens of divers and then a couple of hundred people to then take the boy from Camp 3 to put him on a plastic stretcher and physically carry him over very undulating terrain in the cave out to the entrance. So all up, there was well over 100 people involved.
That's amazing. And then one person died. One diver died?
Correct. Tragically, a Thai former Navy SEAL, whose name was Sunan Gutnan, he volunteered to help with the rescue, and specifically his task was to bring in those spare air tanks that were so necessary for the rescue itself. He and his dive buddy completed their mission. They dropped off their tanks, and keep in mind, each of these tanks weighs 15 kilograms.
Let's pick up that story, Liam, right after the break. Tell us what happened to him. He, too, is a hero, and we'll take phone calls next.